when I'm awfully low. When the world is cold, I will feel a glow just thinking of you and the way you look tonight.
Welcome to The Sandman Slept Here, part of the Justice Society Presents feed on the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm one of your co-hosts, Ryan Daly, alongside Paul Kean. Hello, Paul.
Hey, Ryan.
And Max Romero. What's up, Max?
Oh, just my dander as usual.
His dander is up. Get ready.
This is not a dirty show. Max, come on now.
Dander.
Although with what we're talking about tonight, maybe it's not, you know, maybe it's apropos.
This might as well be an after dark show anyway with the subject matter we have to talk about every 2 months. Folks, on this show, traditionally, we review the comic book adventures of the Golden Age hero Wesley Dodds, better known as the Sandman, with a particular focus on the 1990s Vertigo series Sandman Mystery Theater. This episode, we're covering Sandman Mystery Theater issues 21 through 24, a story arc called Dr. Death.
This episode is sponsored in part with your Patreon support. Running the Fire and Water Network with so many shows requires a lot of online hosting and other services. A while back, we realized we need some help with the expenses, so we launched a Patreon, and you folks really stepped up to help keep the network going. If you're enjoying shows on the Justice Society Presents podcast feed, the best way to support the show is by visiting patreon.com/FWPodcasts.
And while you are there, please consider supporting the Fire and Water Podcast Network. At certain tiers, you'll get mentioned on the show of your choice, just like our all-star squadron of supporters who asked to be recognized specifically on the Justice Society Presents podcast. Our thanks to
Alex Asias,
Bill Baer,
Bruno Diaz,
Chris Mort,
Craig Fletcher,
DC Dave,
Devin Clancy,
George Van Note,
Jason Keen,
Jeffrey Owens,
Jordan Jennings,
Keith G. Baker,
Kevin Wetter,
Mark Baker Wright,
Matt Ev,
Michael Bailey,
Michael Crouch,
Mike Zumkowski,
Roger Preeb,
Russell Burbage,
Symbol Pending,
Ted Kilvington,
and Tim Price.
Again, please visit our Patreon at patreon.com/FWPodcasts.
If you don't know by now, that's okay, but we'll let you know. The digital is available on the DC Universe app, but you need the Ultra subscription to read Vertigo books. But if you like imprint better, the first half of the series or so is reprinted in several trades, as well as Compendium Volume 1, which is what I'm reading from. The Compendium Volume 2 came out last year and is the only place most of the second half of the series has been reprinted at all. So get it before it goes out of stock.
All right, guys. Before we get into the meat of this story, which, as I mentioned at the top, is called Dr. Death, I'm going to hit you guys with a secret question, because that's kind of what our network has become now. It's just the home of secret questions. So we're going to talk a little bit about evil doctors in the bulk of the show and later on during the listener feedback section. But before that, without giving away too much personal stuff that you might not want to give away, what is your worst experience with a doctor? And while you think about that, I'll give my own answer to give you guys a minute. And this isn't a horribly embarrassing thing. It's just something that kind of always kind of sticks with me. When I took Reese to a pediatrician several years ago, my son is very skinny, like skin and bones, like bottom 5% weight for like his age group and everything. He doesn't eat. And he's been like that since he was a newborn baby. He just doesn't eat a lot. He has no appetite. He's not lacking in energy. So I don't know if it's osmosis. He gets it from the sun, but he doesn't like consume nutrients, but he seems to have boundless energy. So anyway, we're taking him to a pediatrician for that. And you know, apropos whatever, the pediatrician just happened to ask if I was his biological father. And I was like, none taken. Thank you for asking. Yeah. I was like, I'm just going to sit here with that. Thank you very much, doctor, for that professional question.
Wow.
So then, yeah, after that doctor's appointment, I ran 3 miles as fast as I could just to try it.
That's pretty funny. Well, for me, the story I came to my mind immediately. I was first, you know, probably in my early 30s, first time I went to get a physical, because that's kind of what you do, right? You know, I have a father now, and I'm going to go get a physical. And the doctor that we had, which I didn't go see the doctor very often. I wasn't very, you know, I'm a pretty healthy dude. But I went and he was pretty old school. So rather than the blood test for checking my prostate, he did it the old school way. So that went, and I had no idea what he was about to do. So I was like, whoa. And so that was probably, I still remember that. Not fondly, let's put it that way. How about you, Max?
Well, I think you guys know, and I'm not shy of talking about it, but I'm a cancer survivor. I had testicular cancer and, you know, got that taken care of with surgery and radiation. And I have nothing but good things to say about all the doctors I had to do with that. That was like probably the scariest medical thing I ever had to go through. But my doctors were top notch. The one I remember all the time, for some reason, is when I was a kid, we used to go to this dentist who I swear had like George the Animal Steel size hands. And he would just like go right into this, my little child mouth, just with these big hairy mitts, and just kind of like root around in there and say, you're fine. Well, why? And actually one time he asked me if I sucked my thumb. I was, must've been like six by that time. And he asked me if I sucked my thumb and I was like, no. And he goes, are you sure? I'm like, yes. And he was just not a great dentist. Luckily, he didn't put me off dentist. But yeah, I don't know what his deal with. I can still picture those hands today.
So hopefully you got what you were looking for there, Ryan.
No, that's good. That's good. And funny thing, listeners, Dr. Ange is in all of our stories. He's
yeah, you know, I was in Boston back then.
Yep. Oh,
yep. He did make me go on a 5-mile hike after that.
All right, folks, for the story arc, Dr. Death. Now, we're going to talk about the covers in a second, but recall in the last episode, we took a little bit of a detour because we covered the annual, which we were sort of trying to place where that fits chronologically in the larger narrative, because where we ended with issue 20 at the end of the Scorpion story arc, Diane saw that the Sandman left these little origami things when he gases somebody. And she recognized that as something that Wesley Dodds was fond of and a bit suspicious. So she has some questions and we'll see where those questions lead to in this issue, in this story arc. But first, let's take a look at the covers. The cover for issue 21, I think every story arc gives us at least one Sandman hero shot type of cover. It's the guy, he's in his mask, it's out of focus, terribly contrived. But we get a little bit of a vial, like a medical vial or beaker kind of on the side of it. We get one of those little text blurbs running down underneath the title. It says, deep in the unyielding shadows, his fatal diagnosis was cast in ink.
Which sort of tells us about the story right there, right? I mean, it's just interesting how that all worked out, yeah.
You know, I like these. And I think what I like about them, it's, I still have the same complaint that I have had, but there's nothing you can do about it. They look dated just because of the art style and the way they were done. Mm-hmm. But I do like that you, this is going to sound so old man of me. I like that you can see what's happening. A lot of these covers have been very busy. There are a lot of overlays, a lot of things to kind of, a lot of layers to peel apart. These are very straightforward compared to some of the covers that we've seen before. And I appreciate that, you know, and they're still tied into with the stories, you know, that they're for, which as, you know, comic book fans, we know is not always the case.
I like this cover better than several of the ones that we've had. It's not my favorite of the four. We'll get to that, but I do like it. I like the muted colors on it, and so I'm on board with these a lot more than the past few.
We were definitely getting to the point where some of the covers were getting a little bit too obscure, some of them just badly printed and hard to figure out what was going on. That was definitely kind of the most frustrating part when we got to some of those covers. And these four, I like all four of these covers in the story arc. And certainly this one being, you know, the shot of our hero makes it stand out the most. The cover for issue 22 shows a close-up of a piano and somebody lying on the piano, possibly asleep, possibly dead. But he's got his hand on a glass and the text says, the sonata cut short by an unexpected note.
I like this one too. This is my second favorite. This is we know, I mean, clearly there's been a murder or an attempted murder anyway. Clearly he's about to spill his drink. We wonder, has he been poisoned from his drink? You know, he's clearly a pianist. So, yeah, to me, this is, it's not exactly an action shot, but it is at least a descriptive shot.
I like this one too. And one of the things about this set of covers is that they are, like you said, they're photos, they're out of focus, but you know, it works in this case. In this one, you can kind of see the prescription that Dr. Death has been writing in the background, which is a nice touch. You know, the Sandman Mystery Theater issues have me like looking for clues in everything. and I noticed that the pianist's hands, you know, he's laying face down or on his arm, but his finger is pushing a key. And, you know, and that makes me, of course, just, you know, wonder, what does that mean? What is it? Probably doesn't mean anything. But, you know, that's just kind of the power of this series.
I didn't notice that. I thought you were going to say the skull's head on top of the caduceus. I'm not sure how to pronounce that. Caduceus.
Yeah, yeah.
Properly, I'm sure. Andrew will correct us if we get any medical things wrong.
Yeah, that's the symbol of Dr. Death, and we'll get into that once we get into that story.
On the cover to number 23, we get a shot of a close up of Wesley's kind of Sandman doll type of thing. I don't know if we've come up with an actual name for this other than the Sandman doll, but it is a close up of that with in the background a shot of shadows of what appear to be a man and a woman. Sexy time? I'm trying to think there's probably a more delicate way of saying that, but. And then the text, if that wasn't, you know, clear, the text just says, skin on skin, their secrets fell away with the night. I'm pretty sure that was from a poem I wrote in high school.
This one's my favorite because it really does tell us what's going on, as we'll find out. An important event in Diane and Wesley's life occurs this issue, but I just love the idea of the doll getting a cover. So that's just a great sort of watching as this is going on, which is a little on the creepy side.
Yeah, a little voyeuristic, but I like that.
Yeah. Okay, we have it on record. Ryan likes to watch.
Yeah.
I like this cover a lot. This is probably my favorite cover of the four also. I think I had that tie that the doll is wearing at some point. One of the things I like about it is that the silhouettes of the couple in back, pretty obviously, well, to me, they look like they're cutouts and that they were used to create those shadows, which I thought was an interesting touch, you know, because it's the doll and it's almost like, you know, these just like shadow puppets almost. And it's just an interesting way to put that together. And on the sides, the background image is pens, which is interesting because to me, that makes me think of the prescriptions that Dr. Death is writing. But it also makes me think of, and we'll get into this also, is Wesley spends a lot of time in this issue trying to track down handwriting samples.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so I thought that was a kind of a subtle way, a kind of a subtle nod at that.
Mm-hmm. I also, when I looked at the background shadows of the couple, my first thought was kind of like puppets or something, a little bit like they weren't like normal human models. There was something proportionally like a little bit off. And I like the idea of maybe just like cutouts, like the shadow puppets and everything. And the splash of color with like the purple on the background and the purple on the doll's face. This is not only my favorite cover of this four, this is one of my favorite that we've seen so far, like in the series up to now.
Yeah.
And then this the cover for number 24, it's a guy. It's just a guy sitting there who we will identify in the story as Dr. sort of Raymond Kessler. And it says, his compounds of chemical death poised, his true bedside manner revealed.
I think he's the bad guy. Yeah, I just thought this one was kind of dull. I mean, it's the clearest one. His face is clearly in focus. I think he's in a car. I'm not sure. Is he in a car? I don't know what he's doing. Like all around him gets less in focus. But then we do see the poison on either side, which is, you know, another indicator. I don't think there's anything wrong with this, but it's not going to like compel anybody who's not waiting for the fourth chapter to buy this comic book.
Yeah. I think it's a little bit of a giveaway because the person in the photograph looks like one of the suspects, but you know, I was going to mention this later, but you know, when it's revealed who the perpetrator is, it's not really that much of a surprise. It works. The thing I do like about this about this cover is the contrast between this kind of orange tone in the middle and then that green on either side for the poison bottles and that sort of thing. I do like that contrast. I don't think the photo is necessarily very compelling, but I do like the colors.
Well, it's always kind of a weird thing when you get a photorealistic cover of a character from a comic, but it's not like our leading character. It's not a superhero. It's not somebody wearing a costume. It's literally, it's just a guy with a suit and a mustache, a very thin kind of pencil thin mustache. It's a guy we've never seen before. We will never see again. So to just get a photorealistic spotlight cover, all that, it's like, it seems just an interesting choice of, you know, like real estate. It's clear. Like, again, I don't dislike any of these covers. They're all good. And as Max said, maybe it's just the fact that we can see what they are.
Maybe that's what we come to. Well, my question just occurred to me, you know, the covers are more straightforward. The story, you know, I don't think give away anything, but I really enjoyed it, but it's a little more straightforward as well. It's not as twisty and turny as some of the other ones. I wonder if they were getting some feedback that maybe they need to just, you know, not simplify, but maybe make it a little more reader friendly. I don't know.
It's possible, because I noticed that too. I thought it was very, I mean, there's this story is more of a crime story than it is a mystery story.
Yeah.
And like you said, Paul, it's pretty straightforward. It's not that hard to figure out who it probably is.
But I can imagine that it was harder for Wes than it was for us, right? Because we saw a lot of stuff that he didn't see.
But I think one of the things that's, and this kind of goes to your point, Paul, is that it is a simpler story, but I think maybe that's because it's really a story about Diane.
Yeah, that was what I was going to say. Like, the crime aspect of it, Dr. Death and what he's doing and everything, is really of secondary interest in this, because the story, the meat of this, is really Diane having this sort of crisis of trust and what she's willing to accept and where this kind of takes her. But we're getting ahead of ourselves. Let's actually tell our listeners what happens in the story. The writer, of course, is Matt Wagner and Stephen T. Siegel. The artists for this one, Guy Davis did the layouts for this one, but the pencils and inks were finished by Vincent Locke. He did a lot of these. He was primarily an inker, and he did some work on the Sandman, like the Mother Sandman title, and some other stuff around the same time. Lettered by Gaspar Saladino, colored by David Hornung, and edited by Karen Berger. Issue 21 has a cover date of December 1994 and an on-sale date of October 11th. Diane Belmont goes about her normal daily life as if she didn't just discover that her boyfriend, Wesley Dodds, is secretly the Sandman. Wes notices that she is more distracted and distant lately, but she is not ready to confront him. A former boxing champ named Eddie Robinson, who now works as a delivery man, brings a package to a doctor's private office. The doctor seems oddly interested in Eddie's well-being. He offers him a drink and writes a prescription. Later, Eddie's body ends up in the morgue, where the coroner, Hubert Klein, finds the prescription written for an eternity of rest. Diane visits her cousin Lucy and meets her boyfriend, Dr. Raymond Kessler, who invites Diane and Wes to a function at the American Medical Association. They see a performance from a once-renowned concert pianist, Vladimir Velikovsky. In the men's room, Velikovsky finds someone slipped a prescription in his pocket and throws it away. Wes reads the prescription for permanent retirement and abruptly ends his date with Diane, which sets her alarms off. That night, the Sandman visits Velikovsky, but before the pianist can answer his questions, he succumbs to a poison and dies. The Sandman returns home unaware that Diane has staked out his house.
Issue 22 has a January 1995 cover date and an on-sale date of November 22, 1994. Lucy's boyfriend, Ray, is quite vigorous in bed and quite well endowed, too, as Lucy tells Diane.
That's why we had you read this part, Matt.
I don't know whether to be flattered or insulted. After examining the body of Vladimir Velikovsky, Hubert Klein tells Lieutenant Burke that he suspects the murders of Velikovsky and Eddie Robinson are connected. Burke disagrees, but the Sandman is much more receptive to the idea. Klein tells the Sandman he thinks the killer is a left-handed physician. Lucy pays a surprise visit to her boyfriend and gets a surprise of her own when she finds Ray in a heated argument with his adult son, Roman. Diane grows more and more conflicted over her suspicions of Wes. She orders a piano delivered to Wes's house just to distract Humphreys so she can sneak inside and snoop around. She doesn't find anything incriminating and returns home disappointed. Lucy and Ray are waiting at her house to see Diane's father, Larry Belmont. While there, Diane gets an eyeful of how physical the couple gets when they're alone.
Issue 23 has a February 1995 cover date and went on sale December 13th, 1994. After having sex again, Lucy wants to know more about Ray's son, Roman, but all Ray wants is more sex. Wes receives a list of left-handed doctors and is suspicious of one in particular, a Dr. Turner. Wes arranges a physical exam with Ray Kessler to learn more about Turner. Hubert Klein realizes that the killer's prescriptions are treated with a chemical that reacts lethally when combined with alcohol. He places an anonymous message in the newspaper warning the Sandman. But Diane decides that tonight's the night she will make love to Wes and learn all his secrets. Humphreys sees Klein's message in the paper, but Diane comes over to the house and makes Humphreys leave so she can be alone with Wes. Humphreys, though, makes her promise not to give Wes any alcohol, contriving a fake allergy on Wes's part. When Wes comes home after joining Drs. Kessler and Turner at a club for nude dancers, he's surprised to find Diane waiting for him in his bedroom. His plans to go out as a Sandman that night are put off so he and Diane can finally make love. After, as Wes sleeps, Diane gets to snoop around the house and discovers the secret passage to the Sand Cave.
Issue 24 has a March 1995 cover date and an on-sale date of January 17th, 1995. Wes finds Diane in his secret Sandman lair. He tries to explain why he does what he does, that his prophetic nightmares compel him to fight evildoers. Confirmation of her suspicions doesn't make Diane feel any less shocked and betrayed. After she leaves, Wes dons his costume and confronts Dr. Turner, but ends up eliminating him as a suspect, while learning that Ray Kessler may not be a real doctor after all. Lucy goes to Ray's house to surprise him. Roman Kessler warns her that she doesn't know his father as well as she thinks. When Ray comes home, Lucy confronts him about cheating on her. Enraged, Ray rapes her. The next morning, Lucy calls Diane to pick her up from Ray's house. She tells Diane that Ray raped her and about a mysterious locked room in Ray's home. Diane takes the key to sneak into Ray's home. Hubert Klein tells Sandman what he knows about the poison and that Ray Kessler's medical degree is bogus. Sandman tells Hubert to send the cops to search Ray's house. Already there, Diane enters the locked room and finds Ray's elderly, bedridden mother kept in a constant drugged state. Ray catches Diane in his house and is about to kill her, but the Sandman rescues her and gives Ray the gas. A grateful Diane hugs the Sandman, then pushes him away. Sandman flees the scene as Lieutenant Burke and the cops arrive. Alrighty. As I was saying, the story about Kessler being this doctor of death and killing these people, I think, is really kind of secondary, because really the theme of this story, and this is asking the question that we get in so many superhero comics whenever you have a secret identity, is the hero right or wrong to hide his identity from his loved ones? Is hiding that a betrayal of trust? Does that imply that they can keep other secrets? Are they really doing it to protect their loved ones, or are they protecting themselves because the loved ones might not accept this? And by keeping the secret, they're avoiding that confrontation. So these issues did a good job of kind of exploring that from Diane's POV.
I look at it two ways. So when there's somebody who has a secret, let's say Wes, or let's use Barry Allen as another example, and then they get involved, in Barry's case, get married to their significant other, it may be almost, when is the right time to tell them? Because when you first start dating somebody, you don't know it's going to last, right? You don't know how trustworthy they are. So when does that translate into the time to tell? I don't think there's a good answer. And I guess from a relationship standpoint, every relationship's different. So I don't believe the I'm protecting you thing. I think what you said at the end, that it's easier to not have that confrontation in real life, that's probably what would put people off the most. That's just my personal opinion. But I don't know. I think those things are very interesting, you know, and they avoided that confrontation in 1968 or whenever, when Iris, when Barry finally tells Iris, and she says, "Yeah, I've known for a while. You sleep, you talk in your sleep. I've known since our wedding night," right? You know, things were simpler back then.
You mean
right?
They waited until they got married?
That's what kind of the implication was. You know, that's why I picked it to contrast, right? In this situation here. Mm-hmm. Is the right time? Would Wes have decided to tell her after they were intimate, you know, the first mm-hmm. time? I don't know. I mean, I think not. I think he would try to avoid it as well.
And well, as we saw, Wes has been struggling with this for, yeah. you know, for a couple of storylines now. And yeah, for me, the question is, would he have told her if Diane hadn't figured it out herself?
Right.
And I really don't know. You know, we have seen that Wesley is a very private person. At one point in the story, he's telling someone that he is tired because he has dreams. He had a nightmare, and mm-hmm. he's still trying to shake yeah. it off.
Yep.
And he says, "Oh, well, tell me about it. You know, it helps to talk it out." And Wesley says, "I don't talk about my dreams with anyone." You know, he's just an extremely private person. And the only person who knows he's the other side of that coin is Humphrey. Humphreys does know that he's a Sandman. So obviously he can trust people. He can learn to trust people. And the question is, why is it so hard for him to trust Diane? Is it because he is worried that he's going to lose Diane, that he's going to lose that relationship that has come to mean so much to him? Or is he just stuck in that mindset of, you know, that he can't trust anybody? And, mm-hmm. you know, and this is something that we see Diane kind of struggle with throughout the whole storyline. You know, she goes back and mm-hmm. forth about it. And she talks a lot about trust and secrets and mm-hmm. and what that means for a relationship. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm not sure that is completely resolved even after, you know, mm-hmm. Wesley confirms that he's a Sandman. And I think I appreciate that. I appreciate that there isn't an easy solution or an easy mm-hmm. resolution to it.
The only mm-hmm. thing I want to mention, Max, is that we found out just last month in the annual, Humphreys found out by accident, right?
Right.
Yeah, I was going to mention that. And so Wes didn't tell Humphreys.
Wes didn't tell him either. Right, exactly. So both Humphreys and Diane figured it out on their own.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm inclined to believe that Wes would tell her eventually. And part of this is just foreknowledge of where they go. But I think while it might not have been accelerated to this degree, I think we see the track of their relationship is they're not just boyfriend, girlfriend. They're not just lovers. Like, she becomes his best friend in every way. And I think at that point, yeah, I believe he would have told her, but had she not found out, it, you know,
it might chicken have or egg, man.
50.
Yeah. Chicken or egg. Right. You know, right. Who knows, would she still become his best friend if she left right. because he was keeping secrets and she couldn't figure out what it was, you yeah. know?
And also the question of like, how much are they protecting their loved ones? You know, there's always like, I think we tend to think like they're protecting them from villain reprisals. I think like that was always like Superman's, like he didn't want to put Lois and Jimmy and everybody else right. in danger. Whereas you think of like Spider-Man, he was protecting Aunt May from herself because he thought her knowing the truth would give her a heart attack. She would be like right. protecting her from the fear of watching him go out every night,
right.
which is why I thought the issue where she actually finds out Peter Parker is Spider-Man, which is in the 2000s, it was an issue written by J. Michael Straczynski. It was a really, really cool issue all about May. But it's an interesting, it's one of those things where that argument doesn't hold up really well when you put it. Keeping them ignorant in the dark, is that keeping them safer?
I think that's especially true with Diane, because like, you know, it just clicked right now when you mentioned Aunt May. You know, it's always this idea of protecting your loved ones, you know, protecting mm-hmm. Aunt May's health, protecting, mm-hmm. you know, Lois and Jimmy and, you know, whoever else. But that makes me wonder, in Wesley's position, a question I would ask is, does Diane need protecting? And I would say at this point, what we've seen is no. You know, she's perfectly mm-hmm. capable on her own.
Up until the last page of this issue.
But I was going to say, yeah.
Right. The point is, she does seem to get
in a lot of trouble.
She does.
That's the other argument you could make, is based on how inquisitive she is, based on how quick she is to put herself in these situations, she would have figured it out eventually.
Yeah.
If it wasn't in issue 20, it would have been issue 24 or issue 28 or something like that. She would have found out if he didn't tell her, because right. that's just who she is.
Yeah.
Getting into the story, in Act 1, she's kind of obsessively thinking about this while she's like swimming at the YWCA. And we meet her cousin, Lucy. And I gotta say, like, at this point, it kind of gets confusing. It's like, okay, do we know that? Is this one of Diane's friends or college roommates or one of the other girls who has been a damsel in distress in the story yet? Yeah. Like, it seems like every story arc, she has a friend who ends up getting killed or threatened or in danger or something like that. So.
Yeah, right. She does have a lot of friends. I agree. But
right. Yeah, and that is kind of a trope that Wagner is leaning on a little bit too heavily, I think. You know, it's becoming less than coincidental. But yeah, I do think it's interesting to see some of Diane's family and to know that there's an Uncle Bill who apparently is semi-estranged from her father. For reasons that aren't revealed,
has something to do with Diane's mom, her death.
Yeah, yeah.
Which we don't know anything about, so that's clearly a seed that's been planted.
Right. Which might be the only reason that it's a cousin. But yeah, but it, you know, the thing is that for me, a lot of Diane's friends are, you know, they're perfectly fine people. You know, I don't have a problem with that. But Lucy might be the first one that I actually liked as a person. You know, I cared about Lucy and what was going on for her. And they do mention that she is younger than Diane. She's younger than Dr. Kessler. She's younger than Ray. They mentioned that he is an older man. And Wagner and Siegel do a good job of bringing that youth forward. She seems like a young woman. And that's one of the things that I liked about how Lucy was portrayed.
And one of the few, like in that first scene, one of the first things that Diane says about her is how she's so young and fit. She's obviously very young, but very beautiful too. And Diane even has a thing where she says she feels ancient. And right there, kind of, we're getting this idea of the theme of aging and this, you know, contrast of age and youth and the way that kind of sets off the villain for whatever reason.
Yeah, which becomes the whole linchpin of the story as we find out. But yeah, no, I thought it was very interesting. But you know, talking about the art, you know, this is the art from Vincent Locke. Has Diane looked as luminous as she does in the in these issues?
I love this
artwork.
I mean, I think he pretties her up quite a bit.
Yeah,
especially in a couple issues when she goes to Wes. In his bedroom. She looks good. Right.
Yeah, which in a way I appreciate. I mean, she's still recognizable compared to the other issues, but I think the other issues also can make her look older than she's supposed to be. A little frumpy. I actually kind of really enjoyed the way she's depicted here. She looks age appropriate, I think.
I think the art in this story arc is my favorite of the whole series so far. I was going to make that point as well. I think, you know, it still looks like real people, but, you know, I think, well, I remember us saying, you know, certain other arcs, everybody looked ugly, you know, and stuff. Yeah. I don't know. I really enjoyed the art in this story arc. Mm-hmm. I agree with you, Max. Mm-hmm.
Our first crime, our first murder kind of unveils slowly. We get this guy, Eddie Robinson, a black man delivering a package he's at this, a hotel or an apartment, some building with a guy at the desk. And he's like, leave the package with me. And Eddie's like, no, this has to be, you know, personally delivered. It's medical supplies or something. And he's like, okay, you can take it up. And Eddie's about to go to the elevator. And the guy's like, oh, whoa, service stairway is over there. And he calls him Buck. And it's like, oh, yeah. Blacks aren't allowed to take the elevator. They have to take the stairs out of sight. And you can see how winded he is going up, you know, three or four flights and wipe the sweat off of his brow when he gets there.
Right.
But this is what makes the unnamed doctor say, hey, take a load off. Sit down. Talk to me about your situation. And he talks about getting older and all that kind of stuff, again, with the theme.
And he recognizes him as a former boxer. And Eddie, the engine Robinson here, you know, talks about his glory days, but how age and injuries basically took him out of the fight. And the doctor, who's in shadow the whole time, writes him a prescription.
I love it when you get examples where something is particularly unique to one kind of medium. Because I think by and large, most people think of film or television as kind of a superior medium in terms of like communicating a story or something like that. And I disagree with that, but I think most people would say that's kind of the general consensus. But I like when you see you can do things in prose, or in this case in comic strips, that you could do in film and television. And you could not do this scene and keep that guy's identity a secret in a movie or TV show. Even if we haven't met who this character is yet, like even keeping his face in shadow, like you hear his voice. We would know who he is as soon as he starts to talk. But in print, whether it's a comic strip or whether it's a novel or something like that, we have to make up what that voice sounds like. And we could be on the right track or completely wrong. So I just kind of like that. I was like, oh, when I got to this point, I was like, yeah.
Yeah.
Wagner can keep this character's identity a secret from us, even though it's not going to be much of a secret and it's maybe kind of superfluous. But mm-hmm. he can do that in a way that a TV series or a movie couldn't do it that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's well said. I mean, I really like the scene. I think it's really interesting. It sets the stage and really is a great scene.
Right. I especially like the kind of, you know, spider inviting the fly into its web kind mm-hmm. of aspect of it. You know, he's very nice. You know, Eddie is appreciative mm-hmm. of the attention he's getting from the doctor. You know,
he even gives him a drink. He's like, yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's a good setup.
And there's a good line as Eddie's like, he's really impressed, really taken. He's like, man, I deliver 80 packages a day and nobody treats me the way you do. And the doctor mm-hmm. just kind of ominously count on it.
Right. So, right. Yeah. We see Diane and Wesley having dinner, looks like. And there are a lot of lunches and dinners in this story. it was making me hungry for a Reuben and muscle ball soup and chocolate phosphates and everything else.
I love the panel that's just a close-up of her plate, where just like the way of the fork, like even just with a very simple image, you can kind of see she's just moving the food around on her plate. She's not eating it. None of the portions are gone. Like she mm-hmm. isn't really doing anything. She's just moving sliced carrots or something like that from one side of the plate to the other. And he's like, something up. You seem a little distracted. He's like, I pissed you off somehow.
Yeah, yeah. That's a really good observation. Yeah.
Yeah, it's great. And I love how she's like, she's like, you don't seem comfortable around that. So that's her first try to say, you're not telling me everything. And he's like, I feel more comfortable with you than anybody in my whole life. And she's mm-hmm. like, huh.
Which two things can be true. That can absolutely be true. And he can also be lying to her about the most important part of his life.
Right.
But on page 9, I love the art on this page. When Wes starts to kiss her and you just kind of see her looking off to the side, kind of like cold and disinterested. And then the panel below that is panels 3 and 5. The panel below that, when she's like, yeah, I don't feel so good. I kind of got a headache. We need to call this short. The way her face is rendered by Guy Davis and Vince Locke. I think these panels just look amazing.
Yeah. And so she declines an evening back at his apartment and takes her home, sees her dad. And she who also notices that there's something wrong. And she says, oh, if I need help, I'll let you know, Daddy. So I thought that was nice.
Yeah. And just getting back to those panels on page 9. And this kind of goes to what I was saying about Diane and how she's being drawn by Locke. I was really kind of impressed by the body language is really, really good. But the facial expressions are really solid and do a lot of the job of expressing how Diane is feeling, because she goes from sexy to sad to determined to weary, you know, and you can see mm-hmm. it all right there on her face. And it's just a great job. He did, you know, he did a really, really great job with this arc.
Then we go to the morgue, where we get Hubert Klein again. He's fast becoming one of my favorite supporting characters. Aside from Lieutenant Burke, we get Klein at the opposite end of the spectrum for representatives of the police department. And Sandman and Klein had an encounter in the previous story arc where Klein compared him to these, like, the pulp detective type of things, where he actually kind of brought up that sort of meta commentary of the Sandman and his purpose. But I mean, because that was when, like, Sandman was going to gasp. He's like, no, I have asthma. I was like, all right, just give me the information. I don't have to drug you, I guess.
Well, and later he tells him, you know, when he sends that note through the paper, through the classifieds, he says, your asthmatic friend. I love Hubert. And he is key to solving a big part of how these crimes are being committed.
Yeah, which is cool because, like, he's the actual doctor in this, where the other...
he's the professional.
The other characters he's the one who discovered, who pulled the prescription for an eternity of rest. He's like, that's not a real prescription. And then abruptly we cut back to Wes waking up from a nightmare, but this time we don't see his dream because this is a Diane story. Like, she's the narrator for the story, so we don't get into his dreams. Yeah, then Wes is greeted by Judge Schaefer. We need to kind of touch base with him. And while they're kind of going out, taking a little walk, and Wes is just kind of waxing, like, yeah, you know, something's going on with Diane. We're just, you know, not clicking like we had been. And we find out that Judge Schaefer, maybe a little bit of a scumbag, more than we thought he was. He's cheating on his wife. Also has no idea how a woman's cycle works and then their time of the month.
Right. Yeah, there is, and I think that's one of the underlying themes also in this arc, is there is a lot of just kind of casual misogyny.
Yeah.
You know, not just from Kessler, who we'll see is just, I don't know how R-rated we get on this, but, you know, he's not a great guy. And really, except for Wesley, none of the men in this story are good guys. You know, they're, you know, Schaefer is cheating on his wife. So is Dr. Turner. You know, and it's just,
who has one of my funniest, has one of the funniest parts in the story. We'll get to that.
He really does. You know, but no, I mean, I guess with the exception of Diane's Klein. Father and Klein and when Wesley, all the other men in this story are just really kind of classic misogynist jerks.
Okay. Speaking of which, the next scene, Diane goes to visit Lucy at the stables, and this is where she meets her boyfriend, quote-unquote Dr. Ray Kessler.
I didn't get immediately that he was significantly older than Lucy, just from the art, but other than that, you know, I think we're being introduced to a number of characters we've met now, and there's no indication in these two pages that he was the one that wrote the prescription. Not yet.
Right. And he's obviously a charmer.
Yeah.
And presents himself as a nice guy. You know, he's silly. He jokes. And Lucy is obviously just smitten with him. So, yeah. But, you know, like I said, with this misogyny, we'll see that later when he meets Wesley. You know, he shakes his hand really hard. You know, he's trying to push him into drinking. And, you know, there's a lot of, to use a buzzword, a lot of signs of toxic masculinity coming off of him later. But in this first introduction, you know, seems like a nice guy.
He does. The one tip off though that I see is the on page 15, the bottom center panel, as he's kind of walking away from Lucy, he does either grab or kind of pat her ass. Like,
I didn't catch that.
Her physical, her body, and the way he kind of sees it and is possessive of it and almost kind of obsessed with her body and how much, like, as charming as we do, like, this is our first kind of tip off that it's physical for him. It's what she represents physically more than anything else. She's a physical object that he loves to possess and touch and do other things to.
I hadn't caught that, but yeah, that's, he absolutely does do that. And I thought it was, there's an interesting thing when he says, a little clue to part of how the story is going to wrap up. He says, just tell him to dress like a physician. Like he knows how to fake it.
Right.
You know, and later.
Good one, Max. I didn't catch that.
And later we'll see how true that is.
Right, right. Good shout. Wes is listening in on the police. He's got his little surveillance set up when he's got the headphones. And he hears Klein talk about the prescription and what it's written. So he kind of knows it. And this is good information that he has because that'll tip him off later on. And then, yeah, he and Diane join Lucy and Ray and these other doctors at this AMA thing where they're going to see this famous Russian pianist, composer, Vladimir Velikovsky, and they're talking about how great he is. But this other doctor comes in, Dr. Turner, and he's like, well, he used to be great. You haven't heard him play lately, obviously, and is very dismissive of the piano player right away. So
I think if they wanted to establish Turner as a little bit more of a suspect, they could have done more with this scene, because it's really just the one or two panels really at the bottom of page 17. If they had continued that a little bit more, you know, we might have suspected Turner longer. But that comment is in your head. First time I read it in my head, I had attributed it to Kessler, and not who says it. Turner says it.
Yeah.
It's not remarked on here, but Turner is a black man, and he is a black physician in this sea of white people, and no one really comments on it then, but we will see that come up later. Just how unusual that is for in this time for a black man to have that position mm-hmm. in society.
Yeah, I kind of had the same thing because we see he comes in, he talks, he's like, yeah, this piano player, he's not that great anymore. He's washed up. And then we see the Okoski when they're all having dinner, and then eventually at the end of this issue, he'll be dead. But yeah, if we were supposed to kind of key to it, okay, maybe this guy had a motive for killing him. Like, by the time Wes actually starts to suspect him, like an issue or two down the line, I'd completely forgotten about the scene. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And also the doctor that Eddie Robinson meets in the first one, while he's definitely in the shadows, he's clearly not a black man. If you're going to hide his identity, they maybe needed to obscure him even more to keep right. like even his race out of that. If we were going to use Dr. Turner as a red herring as a possible mm-hmm. suspect, like we know right away, it's like, well, it's a doctor, but it's not that guy.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Right. Yeah. And I don't know if they ever, I still don't, I'll admit, I don't really understand the whole black and white, always black and white thing that Velikovsky says at the end. I'm not really sure. You know, is he just talking about the keys of his piano? Is he talking about the written
the
prescription?
Tuxedos, the black yeah. and white affair? Like he's always playing for these.
It's you know, thing. I hadn't thought about piano, but I think that's again. I think it's a rather clumsy is too strong a word. Not great attempt to get us to suspect Turner, but it was a pianist talking about his life, which was the black and white of the piano. Mm-hmm. I didn't think of that till you said it, Max. But I think that's mm-hmm. what it was.
Yeah. Yeah, because Wes, while they're at dinner, Wes spills gravy on his shirt and he goes to the bathroom. And then Velikovsky giving him, he's like, put seltzer on it. You can wipe the stain out. And then he finds this prescription in his pocket and he thinks it's a joke and he throws it down. And Wes picks it up and reads it. The prescription is for permanent retirement. And it's only because Wes overheard Klein talking about the prescription that they found on Robinson that's why Wes would suspect there's more to this, that there's something afoot.
Yep.
Because then he can't wait to get rid of Diane. He's like, yeah, I'm not feeling well. We got to cut this short. And she's like, okay. So
yeah. Before we move on, can I make a comment on pages 18 and 19? On the bottom of 18, there's three panels zooming in a little bit each time of Wes and Diane. Wes is clearly enraptured by the performance. And Diane's just, first she's looking at him out of side eye. I'm getting a little closer. She's looking at him. And in the last panel, I love this panel. She's looking at him like, man, what are you about? What are your secrets, Wesley Dodds? What's going on? And I really love that sequence and especially that panel. But yeah. Then I have a complaint. On the next page, now again, we're in this case, it may be a clue because Kessler is left-handed. But why do comic book artists more often than not show people shaking hands left-handed? Other than somebody who's maybe got his broken hand or something, in real life, you just don't see it. But I see it a lot in comics. You've got to hear. And it must be on purpose because the previous page, Wes shakes Kessler's hands with his right hand on page 17. But on 19, Kessler's shaking Vladimir's hand with his left hand. And then somebody, I don't know what's going on page 19, the bottom left panel. He's got his left hand reached out. I don't really know what's going on. So I don't know. Do any of our artist listeners, if for some reason, is it easier to? I can't imagine why it would be easier to draw a left-handed handshake than a right-handed handshake, but you see that all the time. I don't know if you guys have any thought of that, or I'm just barking up a funny tree.
I would guess it might just have something to do with the composition of the page and the layout, like where the characters are standing in relation to each other, and how much they want to like shake their hands across their body or showing it. Like,
yeah.
I don't know. I don't have the artist background to like answer that question.
I'm not making this up. Right, you guys have noticed left-handed handshaking in comic books plenty of times before.
I think it's a version of how on TV when people sit at a table, everyone's sitting on one side. You know, I think like it's kind of like what Ryan is saying. You know, I think it's about staging, that you're not seeing someone's back or shoulder. You're able to see the face probably more easily for both of those people. But yeah, but I hadn't noticed that. But yeah, I think you're onto something.
Yeah.
Well. It's a hint, but I think it's too subtle that it's not fully explained. Like, we'll get to this, but I think the end of this story arc needed one more page to kind of wrap up a few things and explain a few things because, well, I think we'll end up finding out is that Ray is not just left-handed, he's ambidextrous. And that's why we see him shaking with his right hand and his left hand, because later on when he's giving Wes an exam, he's writing with his right hand. but other times we see him using his left. So it's vaguely kind of mentioned this idea of somebody ambidextrous, but it's so quickly, and they don't harp on it, because the left-handed thing seems like it's like, okay, well, he's writing with, anyway, we'll kind of come back to it. But yeah, I think what you're seeing there is maybe the artist tipping off that he shakes with both hands because he's both-handed, but it's so quick that we don't even know what we're seeing.
Yeah. It's a good catch. I didn't even catch, that went right over my head.
And then, yeah, Velikovsky is back at his home, his private home, and he's playing the piano, and his hands aren't working for him. He's got arthritis or something like that. It's not working. He's too old for this. And the Sandman comes to visit him. This is when he's taking a drink, and he doesn't seem all that scared. But, and I think later on, Burke refers to him as a defector, because we definitely get he's a Russian piano player here. So maybe it's just this guy has seen some stuff that he has a reason that he wouldn't be scared to see the Sandman walk into his home. But
yeah, I noticed that too, that he seemed a little, it almost seemed a little too easy how quickly he accepted that this man in a gas mask was in his house.
Yeah.
but you know, who knows? I mean, maybe in those, the secret police or whatever was not that, that foreign a concept. So,
And then as he starts to cough up and the poison is killing him, Sam was like, who did this to you? And he says, Black. And Wes, he's like, he was a Negro. Like, that's his first thought. And I think we're, again, kind of maybe setting up that, okay, are we supposed to suspect Turner? But then he's like, Black and white, always Black and white. And then I'm like, all right, is it the piano? Is it the AMA function, like the tuxedos or something like that? Like, I wasn't sure what it was supposed to be.
And it could have been another red herring too, because when I read this, the first thought I thought was, okay, they're doing it in a team. It's a Black man and a white man, but that still doesn't make sense for how he's being poisoned. But I think it was like you said, Paul. I mean, I don't know if clumsy is the word for it, but it's not as effective way of, I think, trying to give the reader potential suspects.
Yeah, I think there could have been ways to make Turner a stronger suspect if they'd thought about it a little or intended to a little. I don't know what the right.
Mm-hmm. And then when Wes gets home, Diane has been waiting for him. She sees why is he coming in late at night?
So when I originally read this again the first time, I thought that she had found his secret entrance. You know how he's got a second garage for the Sandman car, but he comes home in his own car and he's dressed as Wesley. So she just knows, all she quote knows is that he's been out after he said to her that he wanted to be in. So I thought that was interesting.
I'm not sure that is his own car. I think that is the Sandman car, because usually he's driven around by Humphreys.
So how does she know where to look? Because I don't think that other car is right like in the same place as his other garage. I thought that it was established early on that this other garage was like around the corner, around another, not in the same spot. But I don't know. I was confused by that. But maybe they abandoned that and he just goes into his own garage. I don't know.
Or she's just like sneaking around the house, just walking around the perimeter. But it doesn't, we don't kind of get that.
Oh, maybe. Maybe she looked into it.
But another, again, that's another thing that's not explained completely well.
When we start the next chapter, we started off with sex, which is always an attention getter. Like, Ray and Lucy are in bed and just in the middle of their kind of like, body pillow talk, he calls her a little girl, which not shaming or implying anything, but that phrase definitely takes on a different connotation the more you know about him.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that's another, That's part of the buildup in the misogyny we see from Ray. It's always there, but it gets worse as the story goes on.
And here, just because this was something I was constantly looking for, then he's lighting his cigarette after his post-coital cigarette with his left hand.
Oh, yeah. I have to say, and we'll see this as it goes on. And maybe it's just because I saw The Odyssey recently. And so that kind of Greek myth is in my head. But, we'll see that Ray is almost like a satyr. He's hyper masculine. He's oversexed. And he's kind of a monster, we're getting the first clues of that here.
Yeah. He's like, I'm ready to go. Yeah, and she's like, really? And, and he's like, are you okay? And she's like, well, okay. And then he's like, boom, he's all over.
Right.
And And not only that, I mean, we're, you know, really getting into it here. But I mean, as we find out from Lucy kind of later on, that he is a large man, you know, where right. it counts. It hurts her when they make love. Like he kind of mentions it a couple of times in the story. Like, it's like, how are you holding up after that? And she mentioned that she's sore. And then, like, boom, one cigarette and he is back and ready to go. And she's kind of like, are you sure? Like, this is uncomfortable right. for her. And nothing's going to stop him. He doesn't care.
No. Right. Right. It's all about his satisfaction and
right.
not her comfort.
We find out that it took a little while for Burke to find out exactly who Velikovsky was and where to find him, but eventually they find the body and they're investigating it. And Klein is like, this guy's been dead for hours. We lost so much of the so much time, like, and evidence possibly has gone to waste. And Burke is like, you know, get off my back. He's like, don't give me this.
Yeah, we get a lot of Burke in this. Well, not a lot of Burke, I guess not, but we get more Hubert than Burke. But the Burke we get is, you know, it's classic Burke. And I was going to mention this in the previous issue. Klein is talking to Burke, but he never actually uses his name. But somehow, you know, that he's talking to Burke. Mm-hmm. You know, he does say lieutenant, but just the way, I think he says, what? He says, Christ nuts, Klein, or something like that. He curses in a very unique way. And you're like, oh, yeah, that's Burke. Yeah. And he's just kind of stomping around this crime scene.
And then Diane clearly didn't sleep very much, is woken up by Lucy, and Lucy kind of, she's over the moon. She thinks Ray is going to propose to her. She's so excited, and she wants Diane to get, like, come out. And Diane is like, you know, I'm really tired. And Lucy's just not listening to her. Couldn't care less. Like, she's in her own little oblivious world, walking on air because of, you know, her, how crazy she is for Ray. And then, you know, they go out to get coffee or get lunch or something at this diner.
That's when we find out about how, you know, Ray has been, mm-hmm. he's been blessed. You know, Lucy calls it she calls it the Empire State Building. So, which is, you know, probably information I didn't need. Diane seems a little taken aback. But then it goes into a nice little montage of both Wesley and Hubert Klein basically conducting the same series of the same kind of experiments, which I thought was kind of cool. And I like that we see how competent Klein is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I like that Klein just, like, he talks to himself. Like, he's just, like, alone in the morgue, just voicing his thoughts out loud, talking to the dead body as if the dead body is his sounding board, his audience. And that seems very, very human in its own way.
Right. Right. Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And very much in that whole medical examiner idea, you know, idea yeah. of, like, well, I'm just down here by myself talking to the dead guys.
Yeah. Yeah.
So Wes kind of blows it in the next scene because he's like, I just cannot say the right thing to Diane. I love this part. I thought this was pretty funny. I thought it made me laugh, this argument. I don't know what you guys thought.
She's like, you have to, you know, why, you know, sometimes it seems like you don't even like me. Like, you were so quick to leave. He's like, I told you that, you know, my work demands a lot of my time. And he, as he phrased it, I'm sure you'll see how hard it is to manage things when you're no longer living with your father.
Oh, Wes, bad move, man.
And you know what he's trying to say. You know what he means. But she's just like, what the hell does that mean?
Yeah.
And she slams it, and he's like, dumb, Wesley. Very dumb.
and he knows it. He's just,
yeah, he's
just,
like, oh.
He's like, oh, no. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's pretty funny.
You know, and then we go back to Lucy, who's taking a cab to Ray's apartment, just bubbling over. She's telling the cab driver that it's a surprise for her boyfriend. Here's an extra quarter for you. And as she walks up, she can hear yelling from behind the door. She can hear an argument.
And clearly it's heated because when Ray answers the door, he's like, who the hell is I need to, oh, hey. And he kind of has to, like, change his expression and everything when she's like, I'm not mm-hmm. interrupting. And this is where we find Ray has a son, Roman. No love lost between the two of these guys. Yeah, Roman has this line, good going, Dad. At least this one is almost my age.
Oh.
Yeah, and it's Ouch. Interesting because he goes back and forth between calling him Dad and calling him Raymond.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, like you said, no love lost there.
And she, it goes over her head, and this is because she's still, you know, over the moon. She's like, oh, don't let it get you down. Families are tough. And he's like, forget it. You know, let's go party.
And Ray, even he grabs him by the wrist and he's like, you got to show this woman some respect. And Roman doesn't get it. He's like, well, you always said I was a disappointment, so here's another one. And just kind of storms out without like looking back at her. And kind of interesting, you know, it's like, okay, we see this is a volatile relationship. Roman definitely has some anger. Should we suspect him? Maybe we'll learn a little bit more about him next issue, perhaps. But certainly Ray is trying to control this relationship, but failing. So there's something going on about that.
And he is very hard on Roman. He is. Yeah. The things that he says to Roman are just devastating. You know, he's basically telling them what a disappointment he is, how he's never been any good, how, you know, just all sorts of things. And you can kind of see why Roman lashes out the way he does.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Coupling with the way Ray said, you know, little girl when they were in bed, when they were having sex. And then Roman saying, it's like, yeah, this one, you know, she's almost my age. Like she's younger than, you know, Ray's adult son. It's like another bit of a pattern in the, what he wants and what he thinks about with these girls. But and one of my favorite scenes, one of the funniest things, you just see a man in a trench coat and a fedora in the shadows as Klein is asleep on the couch. And you hear Klein, we get the click of the light and Klein is roused up and he's like, oh, it's you. Please don't shoot me. Remember my allergy.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
We see stepping in the light. It's not the Sandman. It's Burke. And he's like, shoot you. What the hell are you talking about?
Yeah. Yeah, I thought that was great. That was great. And here is another one where, you know how we constantly debate whether Burke is a good detective or not? You know, he's like very quick to dismiss Klein's theory that they were killed by the same method. So, yeah, that's a one in the no column.
There. Yeah, and I think this kind of goes, and I mean, and there's dialogue that makes it explicit, but I think it's also the pattern of Burke kind of dismissing people that he finds beneath him, racially or you know, nationally, whatever, because he dismisses, you can see that he's dismissing it because it is a Russian, he calls him a defector, I don't know if he's actually a defector or not, but he's a Russian and a black man. And so I think to him, he's just like, it doesn't matter what happened because these people to him don't matter. So again, you know, it's Burke might be a good detective. It's still hard to tell, but he's
got blinders.
Not, but he's definitely not necessarily a good person.
Maybe this is just me like projecting a little bit, but I also think maybe he's still a little bit pissed off at Klein because of the conversation they had at the scene in Volkovsky's house when they were over that body. And maybe he's just like, he's mad at Klein, doesn't want to listen to his theories. Just, he dismisses it that way. Yeah.
Yeah. I could totally see Burke being the kind of person who doesn't like, you know, quote unquote college boys.
And then as soon as he leaves, we found out, oh, the Sandman is there. The Sandman was in the room listening the whole time.
Which is a great panel at the top of page 14. The second panel and the fifth panel. Both really kind of get that noir feeling, you know, the shadows and the light, you know, from below. And those are just really effective panels, I think.
Yeah. And I mean, the bottom where he's Sandman complimenting Klein, you're a man of keen senses. This is where he tells him to use the personal section of the Times and just a real, you know, confidence boost for Klein, I think too.
And then we get a few panels of, you know, what we now recognize as Wesley's dreams. A room with a window at the end. We see buildings. We see a hallway lined with skulls. We see the outline of Dream of the Endless in that recognizable helmet. But then we see that is not Wesley's dream. It's Diane's.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And
very cool.
Yeah. And I can't wait to see what that's about.
Well, I think
why is she dreaming of dream?
She's in tune with this, you know, with Wes, and she's, you know, she's constantly thinking about Wes and his secrets. And this is the biggest secret he's got, that he's, you know, he has these dreams. That's the way I read it anyway.
I think it's her subconscious telling her what she believes, is that she's got the Sandman on the mind. And so there's a part of dream, Morpheus, the endless of the endless, showing a little bit of himself in her because of his connection to Sandman. So then we get our stand-up comedian Clacky Brown doing a show, bombing more or less. Jokes right. aren't really landing.
We just get the punchlines, but you could tell that these are just stinkers.
Yeah.
you could tell he's a hack.
And the guy running the venue says as much. He's like, yeah. He's like, get out of here. He's like, basically over the hill, washed up. And he gets a package special delivery for him with a prescription, your final curtain call, and a flask with some liquor. And he drinks that. Or maybe he had that on his own.
I got a feeling that was his, but maybe not.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, whatever. Actually, I think the liquor was in the box. Because he's like, Stiffel's just what I needed.
And Right.
When he takes a sip, he goes, don't know how you knew that, my friend, but I'm not complaining. Like,
yeah. Or hesitating. He just hits it right away.
Yeah, you're right. You're right.
And then we get the Sandman going to a black church in Harlem and visiting Eddie Robinson's sister while she's cleaning after dark. And just getting a little bit of information about who, like, when Eddie started delivering these packages and may have been working for a gangster. And it's an interesting scene, but ultimately he's on the wrong track at this point. If he's already suspecting a physician is writing these prescriptions.
Yeah. I'm not sure I know what he really gets out of that scene either.
Right.
But the next scene is hilarious.
This delivery just shows up to Wes's house, and Humphrey's like, yeah, we got this delivery for your piano. And he's like, no, we didn't order anything. He's like, yeah. And so Humphrey's just fighting with the delivery man about this. And Diane takes the opportunity to sneak past Humphreys and get into Wes's house. And I was like, the audacity at this point, she's stepping up her game. Like, she's clearly thinking tactically, but this is a bold thing.
Yeah, and she's looking everywhere, in closets, under the bed, in the medicine cabinet, in the light. You know, she's everywhere in that house. I mean, it is pretty bold. I do like that first panel of the sequence where the delivery driver is saying to himself, get a load of this place. Sheesh, some people got it rough, you know, and you can kind of see how big Wesley's house is. You know, Wesley's doing all right.
Yeah.
And the delivery man, like, the next thing is, like, I got a piano player for a Wesley Dobbs.
Yeah. No, this is great.
It's pretty clever.
And I love how she gets out, too.
Yeah.
She sneaks out by call. You know, she hears Humphrey slam the door on his way back in. And she's like, oops, I got to get going. So she calls from the library, calls the phone in the hallway, and then he is answering. He's like, hello, hello, anybody there? And she sneaks, runs out the door. It's terrific. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's a lot more humor, the surprising amount of humor in this story, too, and some great dialogue. I really like this. And then, interesting little connection here. Wesley goes and meets with a society brother of his. This society brother, Robert Lee, and apparently they have this tradition of intellectual challenges to each other. And Wes is like, oh, what can I give you? Oh, this, you know, just off the top of my head, this just occurred to me. Compile a list of all of the left-handed physicians in the greater New York area.
Right. And, even though I love Robert Lee's reply, which is basically simplicity itself.
Yeah. <He's> like, yeah.
In my head.
Like Wes's friends.
Yeah. Well, you know, they apparently were in the National Honor Society together. And you know, when they're having this conversation, in my head, there was a part of my head that's going, nerds.
He challenges Wesley in return to memorize two whole pages of the New York Times.
Mm-hmm.
Like, mm-hmm. Damn, that's a heck of a challenge.
Yeah.
Diane goes home. She sees Ray and Lucy there. They're going to see they're there to see her uncle, Diane's dad, Larry Belmont. And Diane kind of just eavesdrops as the DA is on the phone. And he's basically saying, he's like, yeah, I don't want to take business at home anymore. I'm trying to keep this stuff away from my daughter. She got too close to the last time. I'm like, yeah. No kidding. This is what a responsible dad should probably be doing, considering how close she gets to every case.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And it, you know, I don't want to jump ahead too much, but at one point, Burke actually tells her, I'm getting tired of you showing up at every crime scene I go to.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's like, that would be suspicious at some point, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
So she goes back and sees Lucy and Ray on the couch making out, and he's got his hand up her dress.
And then she ends with, perhaps there is only one way to really know the man you love. So we know it's on her mind.
Right.
Same thing that was on Ray and Lucy's.
Yeah.
Because when we start the next chapter, Ray's sexual appetite knows no, will not be sated.
Right, because we open this issue the same way we opened the last issue. It's Lucy mm-hmm. and Ray in bed. You know, this time we find them post-coitus, but mm-hmm. Lucy is not enjoying herself. Right. She is telling him that she's sore, and he tells her, "I don't mean to be so rough." Because, but mm-hmm. then he says, you know, "Oh, but you know, you just bring out the animal in me." You know, again, he's just full of this kind of misogynistic mm-hmm. crap, right. you right. know, and making it her fault. And mm-hmm. and later we will see her yeah. kind of internalize that.
Yeah.
And which is, you know, we already mentioned, you know, that she does get raped, which is difficult to mm-hmm. read and see about. But for me, what was even more uncomfortable in a way was watching how she made excuses for it.
Yeah. Yeah. And then apologize yeah. for it. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. That was rough.
Cause then, yeah, in this one, when they're in bed, like, she's like, okay, like, she's like, let's actually have a conversation. Let's talk. Tell me about your son. Like, what was that fight about? What was going on? And he's like, I don't want to talk about it. And she's like, come on, tell me. And, you know, his son, he's like, yeah, Roman, he dropped out of medical school. And it's like, okay, medical connection for the son who we know is angry. Is that dropping a hint? Should we be suspecting Roman might be our killer or something? And then, you know, of course, like, not even like a second later, he's already in the mood again. And she's like, I don't want to. She's like, I can't go again. And he's like, well, you know, you can pleasure me another way. And she's like, can we just talk? He's like, I'll do the talking. Like, you right. keep your mouth busy somewhere else. And basically pushes her head down in his lap.
Yeah.
So it's, yeah. yeah.
The next scene, we see someone leaving Grant's gym, which is, I think, our first real hint at the coming superhero world for Wesley.
Yeah. Is this our first reference, even obliquely, to another Golden Age hero? Like,
I want to say so. This is I can't remember any other ones.
Yeah, I think so.
Because I mean, obviously, we're implying it's referring to Ted Grant, Wildcat.
Right, mm-hmm. and the man when he leaves, he says, "Night, Ted. See you tomorrow." Mm-hmm. So, you know,
yeah.
So yeah, I think I want to say that this is the first real reference we get to, you know, what's eventually going to become the JSA.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, but again, Wes is barking up the wrong tree. Right, he's taking another African American guy. He says, "Kiss
another boxer,
your friend Eddie the Engine made deliveries. You'll tell me who." He tells him it's Montricelli. I warned mm-hmm. him too, and go on. We're like, "Who's Montricelli?" Which another lead that doesn't go anywhere.
Yeah, and the whole time, like, he's gassed and he thinks he's talking to Ted in the scene. Like,
yeah, I don't know. It happens a couple of times where you're kind of wondering, is Wesley just like overgassing these guys because once they start, they can't stop.
Yeah. He needs to get the formula down a little bit better. we'll see a little bit of that in the next story arc, but that's a couple months away. Right. And then, yeah, Diane on the roof having coffee as the sun is coming up in New York. Beautiful little page. I love the coloring in this.
Yeah. And we
then back to the nerds.
Yeah. And then back to the nerds.
Yeah, Robert compiled the list with all of the left-handed physicians, and then this is where he mentions, I also have a subcategory of the ambidextrous ones.
Right.
Yeah. So, and then the best part is, go ahead.
What about you, Wes? Did you memorize two pages of the New York Times? Like, yep. Popeye, you took Sweet Pea on the Sea Hag ship and then forgot him?
Say, what is this?
It's like two pages from the Times. Two funny pages, that is. You memorize the comic strips.
Fantastic. I thought that was great. I know that was great.
And his friend says, sneaky but shrewd. So, yeah, but Diane, they really are nerds. I mean, when he when it starts, Wesley's looking at his watch saying, oh, it's not like him to be. And he comes in, and Robert Lee comes in and says, late perish the thought. You must have set your watch at the bank on the corner, which is notoriously fast. And, you know, again, nerds.
Yeah. Diane shopping at Bloomingdale's, getting a new dress, getting her hair done, new perfume.
And she says that is because she is planning to use all the charms at her disposal on Wesley.
Mm-hmm. He's not going home early tonight. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And then another little great scene with Klein. And he's just like, I don't know if this is like his intern or his lab assistant or just another guy, but he's just got this guy with him, his like assistant. And he's taking him out to lunch. And I just think that's great. That they're just sitting at the diner. He's having matzo soup or something. And that's when he kind of comes up with this this realization that the prescription itself is tainted with something. There's a chemical on that is acting as some kind of base for the catalyst with the the alcohol.
I love it that it's Klein that figured it out. You know, you know, Wes has used his science smarts to figure out other things, and I just think it's cool that Klein figures this out. I'm really liking him more and more as the series goes on.
Klein figures out basically the bulk of this crime, really. Yeah. He's the one who discovers the prescription in the first place. He's the one who discovers that it's a combination of a base and an acid that is poisoning these people.
Yep.
And he's the one who figures out that it's because the prescriptions themselves are laced with something. So this is a great little arc for Hubert.
Wes gets the list. He's looking it over and he recognizes the name Turner, and he remembers what Velikovsky said the night that he died. And he wants to know more about Turner. So he calls Ray Kessler, trying to schedule like a physical appointment or something. They're like, well, he's not in, but like the doctor only does house calls. That's kind of suspicious. Doesn't take patients at his office or at the hospital or something.
Mm-hmm.
But then, like throughout this scene, when Ray comes in, he's talking to him and he's like, what's going on? He's like, yeah, I don't sleep. I can't sleep. I have these dreams. And they're just kind of talking. But here Ray is shaking his hand with his right hand. He's using the stethoscope with his right. He's writing the prescription with his right hand.
Yeah. And
it seems like it would eliminate him as the suspect.
Yeah. Cause he is, they make a point of showing him using his right hand to write.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yep.
And then he asks him about Turner. He says, he's a nice fellow. He says, sure, he's almost white.
Mm-hmm.
Right, right.
So maybe this is where Wes has gone through this black and white thing, you know?
Yeah. I have to say, I never latched onto Turner as a real possible suspect. You know, and none of this was...
Yeah, I do think there could have been a way to make him a more... viable suspect,
we've heard this is like the second time we're mentioning his name, and we've only seen him in two panels.
Right,
he wasn't a big enough part of this thing to be a real viable. Maybe that's what Wagner was trying to do with like talking like to the other black boxer and Eddie's sister at the black church. That was the angle he was trying to imply, that there was a connection, like where the killer was black, and there was some element of that, but. That connection was not made and didn't need to be if it was just a red herring. But yeah, he's like, yeah, why don't you come out with it? You need to relax. That's your prescription, Wes. Just, you know, live a little. Come out with me and Turner. We'll go out tonight. And Humphrey's at home singing or humming the song Mr. Sandman to himself. And he sees Klein's message in the personals. Like, Mr. Sandman, prescriptions are poison. Do not drink alcohol. Your asthmatic friend, as you mentioned. Yeah.
Yep.
Right.
And but then
Humphreys has circled it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But then Diane enters, and go ahead to tell us how what she looks like.
Boy, does she enter.
Mm-hmm.
She comes in. She compliments Humphreys, saying that he smells good today. And he tells him it's a new shaving tonic. And she just kind of like... She's a force of nature coming into that house. Humphreys is overwhelmed. He says, can I take your coat? Can I take your bag? And when he takes her coat, we see that she is wearing, I don't know, you know how to...
Sleeveless black dress with a low cut in the back that goes all the way down.
Right, right. It is a hell of a dress. and Humphreys is kind of taken aback. He's like, I love how in this whole sequence, Diane is in total control.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And she's basically like, get out. And he's like kind of coming up with these excuses. She's like, nope, we don't need you. We'll be just fine without you. Get lost.
Right. Yeah.
I'm waiting for Wesley, and I'm not leaving until he gets back.
She's getting out bottles of wine, and he had just read the thing, and he knows that Wes has the prescription. So he's like,
Yeah, I love his face in panel two of page 15, where he's just kind of sighing and looking up. He's like, okay. Like I can't manufacture a reason to stay here, but I have to stop. He's like, he has to give a reason. He has to save Wes somehow. He's like, you can't let him have alcohol. It's like, why? It's like, well, it's not poison. It's because he's allergic. Yeah.
Yeah. That is a great panel. Cause you can just see that Humphrey's, he gives up. He knows he's lost already. He's just kind of like, oh, okay.
And Diane gets rid of the alcohol, but she's like, another secret. She's like, that he's deathly allergic. So it works, but it backfires a little bit, right?
Yeah, and I think, you know, and we see this throughout this story, is that Diane is very much focused on trust and secrets and what Wes is and isn't sharing with her. And so I think she's obviously, I mean, and appropriately hypersensitive to anything that she sees. It's just another thing that Wes is keeping from her.
Mm-hmm. But this is a good narrative device, because now it does create an element of danger, right? Mm-hmm. That, you know, mm-hmm. will Wes actually drink any of this alcohol and be in danger? So I thought that was pretty clever.
Right. Yeah. Especially since in the next scene, we see that he is with Ray and Turner at a burlesque house.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And they're watching the dancers, and a waitress comes to take their orders, and Ray asks for a martini, and Wes is just like, yeah, just seltzer. He's not drinking. And the waitress is just like ready to walk away, and Ray very forcefully kind of takes her arm, because like, you didn't take my friends, or but like, there's a lot going on here, because the forcefulness with which he grabs her, because she's like, hey, geez, mister, what are you doing? And he's like, you're not going to take his... He's like, you're not going to take my friend's order. And she's like, look, we let him in here. We don't have to serve him. You know, he's like, you're going to serve him, or you're going to, he's like, you're going to get him a glass of bourbon, or you're going to answer to me. Again, like kind of being threatening, taking over. Is he defending Turner because he's black? It's like, well, he's, when he referred to him as almost white, there's some racial elements to it. So I think it's more about having to sort of dominate and not, you know, being disrespected by a woman in this case.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. 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 And in a way, being disrespected by proxy.
Yeah. You know,
that you're disrespecting my friend. You're disrespecting me.
Yeah.
The top of 17, Wes's face in panel 2 cracks me up. So they just watch the dancer finish her show. She's like naked up on the stage. It's like, Wes is like, well, that was really something.
he looks so uncomfortable.
And Kessler is like clapping. He's like, oh, that was more than something, Wes. That was two somethings. That was great. and then Turner likes it too. I don't know. I think it's, I just thought this was hysterical.
You know, and Locke has a very sketchy kind of wobbly line to his artwork, but man, he can really get those expressions down.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I agree.
And Wes says he's always been uncomfortable around looking at ladies that he doesn't know. And he's like, yeah, you should know, you know everything you need to know about them when you've seen them naked. It's like, of course, that's what Ray would say. Right. And then Ray kind of excuses himself to go to the bathroom or something, as Turner kind of puts it, and leaves Wes alone with Turner and kind of trying to get some information. But Turner is just clearly fixated on the girls on the stage and can't think about anything else. Can't talk about anything else.
Right. And that's where we see that, you know, Turner's, you know, misogynist also, because Turner says, well, you look at that, there's another young lady. And Wes says, very young, don't you think? And Turner says, I've got no problem with that. You know, right. So, you know, again, we see that most of the men, you know, are not,
Is Wes the only virtuous person in this world?
Yeah. Well, I think we've said that before. There's not always a lot of likable characters. But he does sign the check, and he signs it left-handed.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And they're like, yeah, we're going to go. And Turner's like, yeah, I'll take off too. We'll share a cab. And Ray's kind of like, you guys are ditching me? You guys are leaving? So Ray kind of leaves off on his own. And as he's walking away, one of the women who works there comes out to like the bouncer, the guy sitting outside, and mentions that one of their dancers is sick. And as he just kind of runs in, he's like, it's always something with that old hag.
Right. Yep. Another victim.
And Wes comes home, almost giving it away with his dialogue. He's like, Humphreys, change of plan. Turner jumped out of my cab, so I'm heading right back out. And he hears the music coming. He's like, what is that? And he follows the music to his room, and Diane is waiting for him.
You know what I just saw the second? When he hears the music, he's like, he's in the study. He takes the book down that he uses to get into the Sandman cave. And that's why the book is on the desk and why Diane's able to find the button. I just this second saw that.
I didn't catch that. Nice.
He's taking it in the middle of the page. He's said, I'm going out. He puts the book down on the desk and he's like, what? But that's from my room. That's my phonograph. Mm-hmm. And then boom, there's Wes in his bed, or Diane in his bedroom. Just saw that.
Yeah, and she's a little cheeky when he finally finds her, because she says, there you are, mystery man. And, you know, I wonder if, you know, if there's a double meaning to that. Sure. You know, if she's saying, "Oh, you know, you're a man with secrets, but also you are literally a mystery man," you know.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And
and he's like, his eye. You could, like, if this was a cartoon, his eyes would be going wooga wooga wooga.
Yeah.
He sees Diane.
Yeah, with good reason. With good reason.
Yeah.
And he's like, "Have you been drinking?" She's like, "Just a little bit. I've been nervous." And he's like, "Huh, maybe I should join you." And she's like, "No."
Right.
And then she has to change tactics. She's like, "Let me relax you." And then.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And then they do it finally. I mean, we've seen they have performed just a sexual act between them.
And this time they actually, you know, share that moment together.
Yep.
Right.
You know, I mean, I have no doubt that it was genuine, but also it seems to be part of Diane's plan that, you know, now that that Wesley is sleeping, she's going to do some more snooping.
Yeah.
Yep. So. And she finds the button and then heads down to the cave.
So Diane, you know, she's not above using her sex as a tactic, which, you know, it works. Nope. Mm-hmm. And we also, like, we on the top of page 22, we basically get the cover image when we have that little shot of the doll and their shadows in the background.
Yeah, you're right. Mm-hmm. You're right. Yeah, that's right.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I like the fact, I mean, for all of his insomnia and his trouble sleeping, it seems, at least for the moment, he's sleeping and maybe sleeping peacefully for the first time. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And she uses that to kind of get up and puts on her jacket or a robe or something and grabs the flashlight. And yeah, I didn't catch it the first time, but yeah, when she notices the book, and that's when she sees the buttons where the book would be in the spot, and that finds the staircase. So. Mm-hmm. Bringing us to the fourth and final chapter of this, Burke and Klein find Rita, an old burlesque dancer, the fourth victim who's now been killed. And the prescription just says last dance. So again, the commonality of all of these victims are sort of older people kind of washed up past their prime. Mm-hmm. And by the killer's pathology or code is these are obsolete people who have passed their time. So Diane follows the steps down. She finds the secret lab and gets a little bit of her own little jump scare when she thinks the same man is there, but it's just his mask and costume hanging from the wall.
Yeah, because Wes says, been trying to find a way to tell you, but now you've gone and cracked the case on your own. I love that line. I thought it was a good line.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then we jump back to Lucy, who is using a not-so-hidden key to get into Kessler's apartment, but she's caught by Roman.
Right.
And Roman is not happy about it, but he's also kind of trying to give her a warning.
He seems to not like her and be like instantly disinterested in her. And I have to assume it's just by association. Like, if my dad likes her, I don't like her. But he does. And for one, he sort of mysteriously locks this door. And then, it kind of gives her a warning. It's like, you don't know who he is. You know, you don't know anything about him or anything about me.
Don't leave him on his own too long. And he says, a stud tends to wander.
Mm-hmm. And Roman walks out just as Ray is coming back, and he's surprised to see Lucy, but kind of happy surprised for the moment.
We do get an important line from Roman. He says, your girlfriend's waiting for you, both of them.
Mm-hmm.
And Lucy even says, what did he mean by that?
Mm-hmm. Right.
But, you know, he tries to blow it off.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Then we cut back to Wes and Diane as she's confronting him, and he is trying to explain. He's trying to tell her why he does it. And it's hard for me to explain because I can't even really rationalize it to myself. And he kind of tells her about his dreams and these visions and of wicked men, and the dreams don't go away until they're stopped. So she's like, you're saying like your visions inspire you to go out in this like quest to fight evildoers. And he's like, it sounds crazy, but yeah, kind of. And she's like, this is too weird. And it's like, this is what everything that she's been suspecting is now confirmed. And she still cannot like grasp the truth of it.
Mm-hmm. She thought maybe there'd be a rational explanation, but this is an irrational explanation. I do really like the top of 7 where he's like, Wes has got his head in his hands. He's like, Diane, you've got every right to be angry with me, but surely you can see why I found this to be a difficult secret to tell. You know, and so it just seemed like the dialogue I thought was really strong in this scene.
I actually really like this sequence because I'm sure some people would say that it's a very talky scene, but that's what mm-hmm. I like about it, because it's also very real. You know, mm-hmm. because, you know, at first, you know, Wes is trying to say, like, I admire your skills. And she's basically trying, you know, don't try to snowball me, you know? Mm-hmm. And then he is completely honest with her about mm-hmm. who he is, what he does, why he's doing it. And like you guys were saying, it's still too much at this point for Diane to wrap her head around, because not only is it what she suspected, it's even more than that. You know, it gets like, you know, at one point she says far-fetched. It's fantastic. You know, like it like a fantasy. It doesn't make any rational sense, like you were saying, Paul. And I like that this conversation goes the way you would expect it to go. You know, any rational person would hear what Wes is saying and going, this is too much. And I really like that truthfulness in this conversation.
Mm-hmm. At the same time, there's another, you know, situation going on with Lucy and Ray, and he's been drinking, obviously. And she says, you smell funny. What, you've been out, you got your perfume, you've been out with another woman. And he's like, hey, yeah, I've always got plenty of juice left for my favorite filly. I'm like, oh, ouch. And she slaps him. Gross. And but he's like, that's not how we do this, little girl. And that's your little girl again, Ryan. I'll show you what that mm-hmm. kind of gets with a real man. And so that's the unpleasant mm-hmm. part there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, knocks her down, punches her in the back of the head, holds her, and I don't know, maybe checks her prostate. I don't know. We'll see.
Yeah, it's it. You can tell that things are gonna go badly quickly.
Yeah. The pain and the horror in her eyes in the scene is hard to look at, but it's well captured by the artist.
Yeah, so.
And we do get a little bit more of a conversation between Wes and Diane. He's still trying to explain to her why he does what he does. Yeah. But at this point she's just mad. Right. And she doesn't want to hear what he has to say. You know, as she says, it's too much. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that argument kind of, hangs there. And we go back to Lucy, who, you know, is being raped by Ray. Mm-hmm. And like you said, Ryan, it's a difficult scene to read. It's a difficult scene to watch. You know, because he is violently raping her. I mean, mm-hmm. and rape is violence no matter how you cut it. Right. But I mean, he's punching her in the back of the head. He's holding her down, and she's begging for him not to do this. But you can tell that he's not going to stop.
Yep.
And as Diane is like getting to the door, and Wes is pleading with her, he's trying everything. Begging her basically, and she's like, yeah, no. She's like, I need some time to think about this. I don't know if I trust you anymore, and I don't know if I feel safe without around you. And she walks out, and he's pleading with her, and then basically just comes out, and he's like, ah, shit. That's all I can say after she leaves.
Yeah. At that point, he's just talking to a closed door. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
You know, he kind of proves Diane right, because the first thing he does is he goes out as Sandman again.
Exactly. Yeah. He's like, well, yeah, he's got a mission. He's got to, you know, solve this thing. So he finds Turner. Turner is heating up some milk in the thing, and Sandman gasses him, knocks him out, and then like drags him across the floor into some other, and is basically just demanding. He's like, confess. And Turner's like, yes, I padded out budgets the last 2 years of the hospital. He's like, hooched the nurse in the emergency 4 times now, cheated on medical boards, got answers from. And was like, yeah, these are bad things. These aren't the confessions I'm asking for. He's like, what about the prescriptions?
Yeah, he basically turns into Chunk from the Goonies. He's just like spilling his guts.
Yeah.
He's like, I haven't written any prescriptions since I quit my practice. Actually, that was something that was mentioned, that Turner doesn't, he was put in administration because he couldn't like practice like as a physician anymore. So when we heard that earlier, I was like, okay, maybe that was part of his deal. Maybe that was like a motivation, but we kind of brought us back. So, and Sandman is just frustrated again. He's like, damn it, I've wasted time on you and Dr. Kessler. He's like, Kessler, he's no doctor. He's like, what do you mean? And he's like, and he kind of just, he's like, yeah, he went away to Chicago, and when he came back, he's suddenly a doctor. He's like, yeah, he's not really. He kind of gives him this thing. And Sandman kind of bugs out of there as Turner's wife comes in and she's like, John, are you in there? He's like, John, what is it? And barely conscious, but still gassed, just lying there on the floor. And he's like, I still love you, honey. I'm just not attracted to you anymore. And she's like, what? That's my favorite part of this story.
That was great.
The collateral damage.
He's got collateral damage. Explaining to do later. Yeah,
of him still being gasped, like with this truth talk and of like confessing after the statement leaves, he's still confessing to the wrong person. She's like, I mean, I guess that's karma, you know, like he did confess, like, clearly as his confession, he was cheating on her. He was kind of a bad guy. So if, you know, if this is his penance, if this is his punishment for that, okay, it's earned.
Yeah.
And then this scene where the Sandman sneaks into Ray's house and he just sees, and Ray is in bed with Lucy and she's awake and she kind of just sees the Sandman peeking through the door and she starts to cry and freak out. And then he kind of like disappears back and leaves them.
I didn't quite get this scene. Like, you know, I guess he decided he was going to go after Kessler, but then he finds Lucy there. He says, not now. Is, I guess, all that I got, but it's a little bit extraneous, if you ask me.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I didn't really quite get that. I guess that's a concession to Diane, maybe, because he knows that's her cousin. But yeah, but it just kind of, yeah. I mean, but also, you know, at this point, Wesley doesn't know that Ray has assaulted Lucy.
Right.
No, he doesn't know.
Because otherwise, I think that scene would have gone differently.
Oh, yeah, that's different. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he doesn't know.
He goes home, he's tired, but he calls and he disguises his voice by just speaking into the glass.
I love the glass that.
And to call Klein, and Klein's like, you got my message? He's like, what message? And he's like, in the Times, he's acid-based compound, or whatever that's the point. And, like, and the catalyst is alcohol. He's like, you can't drink alcohol. And I like this part where, because I misread this the first time when Wes says, I haven't handled any of the prescriptions ungloved. I'm like, that's not true. That might be a mistake because Wes clearly did a couple of times handle them.
Yep.
But then when he's like saying, I haven't handled them. It's like, no, he's lying on purpose to Klein because he doesn't want to give away that he doesn't drink.
Yeah.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. I thought that was pretty good. And, asks him to look into Kessler, into Ray Kessler to see what exactly his credentials are.
Yeah.
And we see him go to bed, fully clothed, looking pretty pathetic.
Yeah. So, yep. It's been
a rough couple of days for Wes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and a mirror image of him curling up like under the blanket, still in his clothes, with the reverse shot of Diane in her bed. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. Diane is still wearing the dress that she wore the night before.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Lucy calls and begs her to come and pick her up from, and to bring a dress and some stockings too. So Diane knows something really bad happened. And
this next scene was the hardest to read in this series of
when she brings her back to
making excuses for Ray and
right
that sort of stuff. And she's,
when Diane's like, "Wait, he raped you?" And she's like, "I don't know that I'd call it that." Mm-hmm. And she's like, "There's no need to get riled up on my behalf." She's like, "After all, I deserved it. If I really loved him, I'd be more understanding, wouldn't I?" And Lucy, this is stupid. Like, what he did was wrong. She's like, "I think you should." And she goes, "I will, Diane, tomorrow. I'll apologize." And Diane's like, "What? Apologize?" Yeah. Like,
that was my reaction.
Yeah.
you know, but yeah, this is a tough sequence. It's because, Lucy has been brutalized and she thinks that it's her fault. She thinks that she should be apologizing for that. And that's just so sinister.
Something changes. It's once she's put together, once she gets dressed, once she kind of put herself back together and everything, she sort of snaps back to what she thinks her place is, like and how she's supposed to behave. Now she's like, okay, we can put, like, we're dressed now. It's morning. It's like, let's put this behind us. And what do we need to do to move forward? And I think that's the attitude shift. And Diane is like, hell no.
Right. So,
but she's like, I just need to get some sleep. And she's going upstairs. She's like, the craziest thing, I even dreamt that a man in a gas mask came into our room. It's like, have you ever heard of such a thing? So here's the thing. Diane now knows that Ray raped her friend. She knows that the Sandman was in their home. So the Sandman is looking into Ray. And she knows from what she's heard, like, there's some kind of Dr. Death in the news or something that her father is investigating at the DA's office. She has all this bits of information. And what does she do?
She sneaks into Ray's house. I'm like,
right. she goes to the bad guy. She goes into the bad guy's lair.
Yeah.
So whatever she's been accusing Wes of, look in the mirror a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Exactly.
I agree. But Wes gets confirmation from Klein that Kessler is not a real doctor. And he tells him to get the cops over there, but he's going to go over right now because maybe he thinks Lucy's in danger because he saw Lucy there last night or whatever. He's going to go over there right now because he didn't have to go over there if he lets him on, right? Because I was trying to figure out why does Wes go over there because it's like the morning time now, right? So why does he go over there? No, I guess it's not morning time. It's like 5 or 6 o'clock because Klein is headed out for the day. Yeah. You're right. He slept through the whole day.
And when Humphrey wakes him, he says it's past 5.
Yeah, you're right. So he gets Klein. Okay, so strike all that. So he goes and he's going to go over to confront him. But meanwhile, Diane has already made it there with her key. And she starts going up the stairs.
And yeah, because it's clearly because Ray is going home for the night. Like he's done. He says goodnight to his secretary or receptionist. And she's like, you know, goodnight, Mr. Kessler. And he's like, that's Dr. Kessler, Arlene. And she's like, yeah, whatever you say, doctor. And later he's like, lighting a cigarette, he calls her a bitch.
Right. Yep.
But Wes is trailing him back to his house, following. Mm-hmm.
And Diane, she sneaks up into the secret room, the locked room, and she finds the secret is Kessler's very elderly German mother who doesn't know who she's talking to, doesn't know where she is or really what's going on, and is apparently gets these injections every day or perhaps multiple times a day. And she's asking to be put out of the pain. She's asking for the injection. And Diane's like, yeah, I can't give you that, but I'll go get some help.
When we finally find out what Ray's motivation is he just cannot stand to see people get old.
This is the part, and it's something you said at the very beginning, Ryan, where you said this is much more a story about Wes and Diane and their evolving relationship than the actual crimes. This guy's clearly a terrible man, right? But he doesn't like this whole idea of killing people with the poison who are past their prime just because he doesn't like it. It's just he didn't really have a motive.
I certainly get the ageism. And I mean, if he was going to target somebody, there are some people in Congress that I think he could have targeted, but that I think are past their prime. And it's a very extreme, like, it strains credulity, this extreme sort of taking out the elderly in this way for this reason. Yeah. But then you also juxtapose it with he's keeping his mother alive past, like, when she should be dying, like, and somehow roped his son into helping him do this. And even, like, when Diane calls him on it, he's like, kill my mother? What are you, crazy?
Yeah.
It's like,
yeah.
I mean, I guess Kessler is supposed to be... In essence, he's a serial killer, but I don't know if that really comes across. And like there, Roman says something about his mother. Are we supposed to think that Kessler killed his wife once she got old, or what? That's me speculating. I mean, there's nothing in the story to point to that.
That's why I wish we had gotten an extra page in this issue, like one more page to kind of break some of this stuff down. Because
we don't get any motivation at all, as weak as it is, until the second to last page of 4 issues. Right? So it's like it seems a little much.
Right.
Yeah.
And I mean, the way he's targeting these people who are old kind of connects us with how obsessed he is kind of with Lucy and her youth, and the way he kind of is sexually attracted to more the younger they are, the more. But even that, then it kind of, I mean, the misogyny is kind of goes in with that because part of it is about his controlling, but it's, I don't know, it just seems like there's a little bit too much going on with him and we don't have enough real understanding of why.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah,
I agree. Yeah. The last scene is great. Diane's like, so happy to see that she's been saved. They hug, and then she realizes, and she backs up and gives him a look like, now I know what's going on. He's like, I got to get out of here before the police get here. But the last
that's interesting because at one point Wesley says that he almost becomes a different person when he goes down the staircase into his lab. And when he's talking to Diane, he says, the police approach, I must go. he's talking, he's still talking like the Sandman. He's not talking like Wesley.
Right.
Yep.
She's so, for one thing, relieved to be saved by him that she wraps her arms around him. And then she kind of pushes, she's like, wait a minute, I'm mad at you. Like, right. She has this moment where she has to remember herself. But also, I thought, like, of all of Sandman's villains, he definitely had the easiest time taking Kessler down. Like, their standoff, their confrontation is like two panels. He disarms him.
Maybe that's part of the problem too. Is Kessler never really feels like a threat?
Mm-hmm.
He is a threat to Lucy, but that's has nothing to do with his crimes.
Murders.
So I guess for me that takes a little bit of the tension out of it.
But we were wondering at the end, is Diane going to break up with Wes? That's the question. She's like, don't worry, Lieutenant Burke. It won't happen again. I promise you it won't. Mm-hmm. And they say, hey, what's that I smell? Meaning he knows that smell because he's been gassing up. I thought that was great.
Yeah, I like that little stinger at the end.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they've been building up this romance, and now it's really kind of...
Jeopardy.
It's a jeopardy, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, a major milestone in their relationship. She knows who he is, that he's the Sandman. She's figured that out. And again, like in the monthly count, like this is, we're 2 years into the book as it was a monthly book.
Right.
We're 2 years in. She has figured out that the secret that Wesley Dodds is the Sandman. They've also finally gone to bed together. So the two major things like collide in this thing. So where does that leave the relationship going forward? What happens next?
And what's really neat in these kind of stories, and this was what was unusual and was, you know, as the comics industry was growing in this time, and Vertigo in particular, but a lot of the comics, they were, the storyline was progressing, right? The status quo is going to be different going forward, right? It's not the status quo of, oh, the hero and the girl doesn't know who they are, and, you know, he's always keeps her at arm's length and that sort of stuff. No, that's clearly going to be different. Either they're going to be broken up or things are going to change. So I think that's, again, part of the appeal of what we said at the beginning, why we really like this series, is that growing and developing relationship. So this is a big change in that.
Yeah. And I also like that her finally finding out does not solve the problem necessarily.
No. Mm-hmm. No. Really quick before we jump away, any final like favorite scenes, favorite moments in this one? I could say my favorite, like I loved when Klein is woken up and he thinks it's the Sandman, but it turns out to be Burke. I like that. Yeah. I like Dr. John Turner's accidental confession to his wife and her reaction.
Yeah,
the funny ones. They were the fun parts of this whole series. So I agree with you.
Yeah, my favorite scene. Was actually when Diane orders the piano to sneak into the house.
Yeah.
Because that to me was just like perfect 1930s, 1940s screwball comedy.
Yes.
You know, very Nick and Nora kind of thing. And it was just, I mean, it's funny that she did that in the first place, but also why a piano? She hadn't ordered anything.
This story, Diane is very much in her head. A lot of this story arc, like she's thinking and overthinking and guessing and second guessing a lot of these things. But the scenes that I think she really spies are when she's taking action, like that scene when she sneaks into the house with the piano, when she goes back to get Wes, when she maneuvers Humphreys out of there, when she's dressed, she's like, nope, I'm coming over. I'm going to seduce Wes. And then when he's asleep, I'm going to find out the truth. And yeah, maybe I'm a simple guy. I did like the fact that they had sex finally. And then when she goes towards the end. So this was very much a Diane story in her kind of rationalized figuring, like finally getting the answer she thought she wanted, and whether or not it's the answer she needed or remains to be seen. But I liked when she actually took action in these chapters, that I thought that was when she was at her best. Because she's just fun. She's just such a fun
character.
She's great.
Yeah, I did like how centered Diana was in Diane was in this story, and I think we've mentioned it before, but I mean, I think she is such a good character. She could carry a book on her own.
Yeah, she's great.
I did like also that we finally got to see Wesley's office, that he actually has an office. You know, we keep hearing how he's a businessman and he has business, but we've never actually seen him do any business. And this, you know, when he gets the house call from Kessler, he is in his office. He has a secretary who I don't know what she does all day, but you know, he actually has an office.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. That's right.
All right, listeners, we are going to take a promo break, but we will be back in a moment with listener feedback from the last episode and our dream sequence questions and answers. Don't go away.
Worlds would live.
Worlds would die.
And DC Comics would never be the same again.
Crisis on Infinite Earths, the crossover so epic it reached every corner of the DC multiverse. Join DC Dave
and Doug Adamson as we discuss The Monitor Tapes,
a Crisis on Infinite Earths podcast.
Find us on your favorite podcatcher and join the discussion at themonitortapes.com.
All right, for the last episode, we got a comment from Dr. Ange from the Supergirl blog who said, "Great episode. I haven't read this in a long time, so I forgot the Murderer's Row of artists. Is this Alex Ross's first work for the Big Two chronologically?"
I looked it up. It's not. It is his first work for DC. Marvel's had just come out. The last issue had just come out a couple months ago.
Leslie Trigg said, "After listening, I went back through the annual with connections in mind. I noticed a cool connection in Chapter 2 when Humphreys finds Wesley behind the wheel of his car injured. I believe this is right after Wesley gets cut in Chapter 4. He is wearing a scarf and not the gas mask in the park. If you look, Wesley is wearing a scarf. Since these are both flashbacks in the nature of stories, I believe these two scenes in Chapter 2 and 4 are connected." I think so. I think, you know, that was intentional.
I think,
yeah, that's a great catch.
It's the Sandman Detective Award for that one. That's great. Yeah, next up we have Comic Foil, who said, "The highest compliment I can give you three is I haven't had time to read the annual or the Scorpion issues before listening to your last two episodes, but your recaps and discussion brings it all rushing back as I listen along in my long drives. Your podcast is my favorite thing to show up on my playlist." Well, thank you very much, Comic Foil. That makes our day.
Yeah, thank you.
Very cool. Very cool. Thank you. Robert J. Smith said, "I may have missed it, but was it mentioned that Chapter 5's photographer, Fiji, must have been based on Ouija, a real-life photojournalist who chronicled the underbelly of New York City in the 30s and 40s? Joe Pesci played him in the movie The Public Eye, and I believe that I read that Ouija inspired the Jake Gyllenhaal movie Nightcrawler." That is really cool. I didn't know. I saw The Public Eye whenever it came out 30 years ago. But yeah, that is a really cool... really cool info. I didn't know that.
Yeah, cool.
Tim Price from the Right On Network said, "I really enjoyed the ghost narration of the body. That really feels like a Matt Wagner kind of story. I do wonder if a chapter narrated by Burke would have given a new dimension to his personality, but honestly, he gets a lot of attention in the series, so maybe that's why he didn't get a focus in the annual. But without a doubt, the Butler was my favorite chapter. I always gravitate to supporting characters getting the spotlight, and Humphreys has been fairly underdeveloped until now. And we see a man with a strong sense of honor and principle, held past jobs before working for Wesley and on a lifelong fixture, who wasn't forced to assist the Sandman, but chooses to. In just a few pages, he went from being a trope to a fully realized character. Simply fantastic." And I have to agree, because, you know, we see Humphreys in this storyline that we just discussed, but now mm-hmm. I'm carrying that background about Humphreys with me. And, yeah. You know, yeah, mm-hmm. and that really kind mm-hmm. of gives another dimension to him.
Stay tuned, Tim, because Lieutenant Burke will get quite a bit of attention in the next story arc after this one.
All right. Next up, we've got Clinton Robinson, who said, "You asked, so I'll answer. Yes, bring in more Golden Age Sandman stories. Not all the time, just as a special treat. Or as an excuse to make Ryan read another story and do more work. Whatever gets me more of this wonderful show as often as possible." Well, thank you, Clinton. That's, again, a nice thing to say. I appreciate it. And yeah, we all like Ryan to do as much work as possible.
Yeah. Santarin said, "I think they are showing the dichotomy of the mugger. He dressed as an allied World War I trench raider, so he has a revolver, trench club, and is wearing what appears to be an M2 gas mask with the British broody helmet. So, if a raider, clearly not someone who hasn't killed people, but is trying not to with what he knows. Also, the M2 would show why the gas had a hard time working as it had to make its way in. Plus, for him, World War I trench fighting would be probably one of the scariest things he can probably think of and would have PTSD from it. Also, I think he is wearing wooden pattens on his feet to show him as an immigrant and his lack of money.
Interesting thoughts. Thank you.
Yeah, I like that.
Anthony Cardino said, I haven't dug up my original issues to reread as you go along, but as someone said above, you're bringing back all the memories. And you, great. It's bringing back memories for us too, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. Network All-Star, the Irredeemable Shag, said, another fantastic episode. Really enjoyed the Golden Age story coverage, probably because of how it echoes forward to the Mystery Theater comics. So if you can find other Golden Age stories that echo forward as well, would love to hear that coverage. Thanks for a fun listen and keep up the great work. Thanks, Shag. Yeah, I think we haven't decided about any more Golden Age, but I find it hard to believe we won't do, you know, a little bit more of that down the road. We've still got a long ways to go. Stay tuned is all we can say.
There are a few other spots I know we can fit them in, but they're towards the end of this end of the run, but maybe sometime in between before that.
Yeah.
We got some great comments last time from our dream sequence questions, which was favorite comic book annuals. Dr. Ange mentioned the Swamp Thing annual number 2, which I really like. He also said Legion of Superheroes annual number 1.
Another good one. These are all good. Yep. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Comic Foil mentioned Marvel 2-in-1 annual number 2. That was the first kind of Thanos and Adam Warlock chapter. Robert J. Smith mentioned Detective Comics annual number 2. Tim Price mentioned Amazing Spider-Man annual number 1 and Avengers annual 10. Clinton Robinson mentioned Action Comics Annual 10, Superman Annual 3, Justice League of America Annual 1, Justice League of America Annual 2, and Secret Origins Special Number 1.
Someone should do a podcast on Secret Origins.
Yeah.
I don't have much to say about that. Anthony Cardino mentioned All-Star Squadron Annual Number 1 and DC Comics Presents Annual Number 1. He also shouted out the Ian Carcool story in All-Star Squadron Annual 2, just for Shag. Bucky749 mentioned Star Wars Annual Number 2 and Sergeant Fury and His Howling Commandos Annual Number 2. And Shag mentioned the Blue Devil Summer Fun Annual Number 1. This time, the dream sequence question is, who is your favorite evil doctor?
And we're being specific, since not just PhD doctors like Dr. Doom, but we're talking MD doctors like Dr. Death, we talked about here, or people pretending to be doctors like Kessler.
Right. There could be like 50,000 evil doctors if we just.
And even that doesn't narrow. Yeah. Even that doesn't narrow the list down a whole heck of a lot, especially if you start thinking outside comic books.
Right.
Right. Who wants to take this one first?
I'll go first. I start thinking about first. I think, oh, I'll try to be literary and think outside of comics and say, oh, you know, you've got Dr. Frankenstein, you've got Dr. Moreau, you know, to some crazy. But then I'm like, can they really be my favorite? And I'm like, so I'm back to comic books. I'm like, well, who are some great ones in comic books, right? Well, I actually looked up one of the things. I looked up, there was a Dr. Death. Okay, who I thought might be a little related to the Dr. Death we got, but he only appeared twice in Detective Comics number 29 and 30. And I read them this morning on the app, and they're short stories. It's the second Batman cover, the one where he's swooping in, and he was interesting. He was demanding tribute from the rich and would kill them with chemicals if they didn't pay up. And so, you know, not the same motive as our guy, but I just wondered if he stole the death. Anyway, I thought that was fun.
You could consider him Batman's first supervillain.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So that was kind of neat. I thought of some other ones like Arnim Zola, who was just like fun because he's just a crazy looking guy. But then the two I had trouble picking between, one we covered quite a bit on Batman Family Reunion, the crime doctor. And he just had a great shtick because he was set up to help criminals. He planned their heists for them. He treated them if they needed medical assistance. I thought he was pretty cool. But I had to go, I think my favorite one who's recurred in enough good stories with Hugo Strange, Dr. Hugo Strange. Has been, you know, made classic, you know, when he was brought back by Englehart and Rogers, and since then has been a recurring Batman villain. So those are what came to my mind as I was thinking through this. How about you guys?
Yeah, that's a good pool.
Yeah, well, Hugo Strange is who I vote at the end. So how about you guys?
I warned you a little bit behind the curtain here. I told you guys before we started recording that this was a deep cut and kind of out of left field. So my choice is Oren Scrivello, DDS, who you might know better as the dentist from A Little Shop of Horrors.
And I
swear I did not think of that, knowing about the secret question. That was just coincidence. But you know, Steve Martin played him so well in the 1986 movie. Yeah. And yeah, I love how over the top it is. He is such a sadist that he's he is frightening. So that I just when you know, I always love that scene, and sometimes we'll watch that scene just to see Steve Martin, you know, chew up the scenery a little bit. And I would be scared to death to go to that dentist.
Well, when you started talking and you started talking about dentists, I thought you were going to tell us it was the guy with the big hands that used to be your dentist.
I don't even want to know what happened to him.
But yeah. How about you, Ryan?
Well, my favorite comic book evil doctor would be Scarecrow, Dr. Jonathan Crane, or Professor Jonathan Crane. Yeah. I mean, honestly, though, I mean, this might be a pretty obvious answer, would be Dr. Hannibal Lecter. We're talking about, you know, just general fiction and films and stuff like that. It's hard to think of a more menacing and scaring, but also captivating villain than Lecter. There aren't many more. My deep cut answer, though, is actually somebody who, a real life person, somebody who existed in real life, but was then given an evil twist in fiction. And it is Sir William Gull, who was turned to be, or personified as Jack the Ripper in certain books and stories. And probably most notably for our listeners would be From Hell, the series by Alan Moore. Yeah. But even From Hell was based on a book from the 70s that where a guy purported that this guy, Sir William Gull, was basically turned the Masonic order, turned him into Jack the Ripper in order to silence these women because they knew about a secret interfaith, interreligion marriage in the royal family. Yeah, so just like that character is always kind of like fascinated me, the idea that a like the Queen's physician might have been Jack the Ripper in secret based on some of those stories. I always kind of like that idea. So in my mind, this fictional version of Dr. William Gull is Jack the Ripper. I kind of like that. The more basic answer really is Hannibal Lecter. But yeah.
Yeah, well, that's a good one.
Cool. Those are good ones. Well, listeners, please, when you write in your comments, tell us who your favorite evil doctor is in fiction, and we'll be sure to read them out next month. Thank you, everybody, for listening. If you enjoy the show, also, please support us by subscribing to Justice Society Presents on your preferred podcast app. You can also help us promote the show on social media by liking and reposting.
You can also leave comments on this episode at the Fire and Water website at fireandwaterpodcast.com under JSA Presents.
And please consider supporting the network on Patreon at patreon.com/FW Podcasts.
Thanks, everyone, for listening. And until next time, pleasant dreams.
Lovely, never, never change. Keep that breathless charm. Won't you please arrange it? 'Cause I love you just the way you look tonight.